90, Justin Brierley. This is Matthew, and in this episode, Andrew and I get a chance to chat with Justin Brierley from the Unbelievable podcast. For those unfamiliar with him, Justin is host of the premier Christianity podcast, Unbelievable, where he hosts weekly conversations, often topical and usually between a Christian and someone who does not share the Christian faith. At the time of recording, Justin had recorded a conversation between myself and Mike De Virgilio, who is the author of the book Uninvented. Please see the show notes for a link to that episode if you've not already heard it. Also in the show notes is a link to the episode where Andrew guested on Unbelievable with David from Skeptics and Seekers. They're on the show talking about our book, Still Unbelievable. We enjoyed this conversation, but we did get carried away, so very few of the questions we had listed were discussed. So for those who submitted a question, it is very likely that your question is not covered. I apologise. I promise I will try to get Justin back again for a follow-up. But do be aware that his show takes up a lot of his time and he is also highly sought after. Hello everybody, welcome to another episode of Still Unbelievable, the first one that we're recording of 2023. And if my maths is right, we're now at episode 90 or thereabouts, which means we're 10 episodes away from the official 100th, although Andrew and I probably have done more than 100 already together in the various bits that we've done. But since we've actually worked out how we start counting, this is how far we've got. So episode 100 should happen this year. We shall see. Maybe we'll announce something at the time. The other thing that I'm really excited about today is the first day of the year I've managed to drive home from work with the roof down. It was cold, but I didn't get wet. The roof was down, so I'm very pleased. That is probably the best news I've had all week. Anyway, this year has started well. A week ago, I recorded a lovely episode on the Unbelievable show with the fabulous Justin Brierley. That will come out in a, well, by the time you listen to this, you should have already listened to that. So let's move on from there. And with that said, welcome to Still Unbelievable, Justin. I feel like I'm a little bit like the jilted lover because I've spent a while chasing you down and I've clearly worn you out. Thank you. You are genuinely a gracious person. It's really nice of you to come on to this.
I'm sorry it took you so long to chase me down, Matthew, but at last it's requited. So
excellent. Here. And I should give you credit. You are the brains between two thirds of the name of this show. So we absolutely need to give you some credit for that.
I only hope that my actual brains live up to that. But anyway, it's nice to be here. And I'm sorry it's taken me so long to come on the podcast.
No apologies necessary. I do understand that you're a busy guy and we've stolen you for an evening away from your family. So thank you for that. While we're actually recording this, my wife, who most of our listeners know, is actually still a Christian. She's out at a deacon's meeting. So that's the way our family rolls at the moment. So that's how you're slotting in into this. What I'll do is I'll just jump straight into the questions, Justin, because I polled the Unbelievable Facebook group for some questions. And there's a few other people who've got some questions. We have not got enough time to get through the questions that we've got because Andrew and I have other subjects that we want to get onto. So let's just get straightforward into the easy questions. I probably know most of your backstory in terms of how you ended up doing this show, but briefly for the listeners who may not have heard you talk about that, tell us how you ended up doing a show called Unbelievable.
Well, the short story is that after university, I got married to my wife Lucy. We went away on a gap year, and before coming back, she was going to come back and train for ministry. She has been a minister for getting on for 18 years. I was able to arrange some work experience on my return from this gap year with Premier Christian Radio. And that turned into a job once I returned to the UK. And I really learned the ropes of broadcasting and radio there. And after a few years in, I said to the boss, could I have my own show? And what I really was interested in doing was creating a space for conversations between Christians and non-Christians. I don't think I even sort of used or knew the term apologetics at that point. I was very new to the whole thing, but that's what it turned into, an apologetics discussion show. And that's really what it has remained for the 17 plus years that it's been going, believe it or not. Started off as just a radio show on a Saturday afternoon. And then a few years in, we started podcasting, started to pick up not just Christian listeners at that point, but non-Christians who wanted to listen to these shows. And then, of course, in due course, we added everything else in terms of, you know, conferences and a book and video side and all the rest of it. So yeah, it's been a wonderful journey, and I'm privileged to have been part of it.
It's been quite interesting watching the Unbelievable brand expand. I have made it to one of your conferences, the conference where you launched your book. I don't know if you remember scribbling your signature in front of me on your book there, but I was there at that one.
Well, I'm sorry to have immediately devalued it by putting my signature on it, Matthew, but I hope it's still worth something.
I've devalued it even more by scribbling in it myself, Justin.
I've listened to everything that I think is the Unbelievable back catalog, and it goes back a long way, something like 2007, maybe, in the podcast app.
That's right.
And I'm just wondering, is there anything else? Is every show that you did under the Unbelievable brand available in the back catalog? Because it has been a fascinating exploration as a skeptic to go back and not only see how Unbelievable evolved, but some people you had on a number of times, right? And it's been interesting to hear those people, the regular voices of Unbelievable, if you will, and see how they have evolved as well. And I'm just wondering if there's anything else left back there.
But for the kind of purists, the completists who want every single LP the Beatles ever released, sort of thing. Well, as it happens, you're right, because what you have from where we started podcasting in 2007 does not include the radio shows that preceded that. Now they are, I think, they're on CD in a desk right next to me, actually. Wow. So if at some point if someone wanted to listen to the ones from the really early days, I could pull some of those off and put them out. But I mean, the show did change a bit in the early, because we started as a live show originally, and we were taking calls from listeners. There weren't really any atheists listening at that point, because it was just on Premier Christian Radio. It was a different kind of a show, and I was finding my feet. So I wouldn't want to necessarily put all of those early shows out for public consumption now. But there were some good shows, some good discussions. And one or two of them did make it into the podcast, because I think once or twice I used some back catalogue stuff from the early days on the podcast as well. But most of it, yeah, is just sitting on CDs from the first two or three years of the show.
As a fan of Unbelievable, I'll just say that there is a thing that I miss from the early shows that it was always sort of part of the mailbag, and people would call in and leave voicemails.
Yeah. So we used to have this voicemail facility, and I did encourage people to phone the number and leave a voicemail message. I can't remember exactly why, but that fell out of use, this particular number. And if I'm honest, it was a bit of extra work to kind of find these messages, cut them down to a suitable size, because some of them ramble for, you know,
sure,
for 5 minutes or more. So it was a fun way of hearing people's voices, I must admit. So who knows? Maybe we'll do a special at some point and get people leaving, I don't know, WhatsApp voice messages or something.
Right. Well, and there's always, as podcasters and people deal with audio, there's always that separate audio source, right? And you've got it in some voicemail system somewhere, and you've got to get the audio from one place to another to get it into a podcast. And so I get that. I get that there's some real legwork there, but it was nice to put a voice with a question from time to time.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Who knows? Maybe it's something we could in some way reintroduce at some point. But
you could always pitch shift your voice, Justin, when you're reading a feedback or something like that.
Anyway, I always love having the feedback. I mean, we could have, in a sense, you know, sometimes people have said to me, I'd really just come for the discussions. I don't hang around for the feedback section at the end of the show. But I've always liked having the feedback section, because it just makes me feel a bit more connected. And I think it helps regular listeners feel a bit more connected. And you just get a sense of how people were responding to the shows, you know. I mean, some weeks the mailbag's almost empty. So I think, oh, well, that one didn't create much either controversy or response. And sometimes it's like hundreds of emails. So it can vary a lot, actually.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the feedback section, Justin. Sometimes I'll go and listen to the feedback first before I go back and consume the show. So I love the feedback section. If you felt like you wanted to drop it, I would deeply miss it.
Okay. Well, I really no plans to drop it. Obviously, it doesn't always land if we have an especially long conversation. I don't always include feedback,
yeah.
But most weeks it's there, and I like including it. I think it's important to hear the voice of the listeners as well.
Yeah, I think it's a great end to the show, and it guarantees that I'd stick it out to the end of your shows. That's for certain.
Good. Glad to hear it.
Is it surprising to you, doing what you do, what shows people decide to feed back to, the ones that cause the controversy? Because very often what I find is that the things that I thought were going to be the least controversial things we could say turn out to be the things that people really dig into. They want to explore. And so I sometimes think I'm just not very good at reading what the audience wants.
That's
and
predictive.
It sounds like, have you gotten better at that over the years? Do you feel like you've got a...
I think I've got a fairly good idea usually of what subjects are going to create feedback. As I say, you hit any kind of really hot button issue with two very different points of view on it, and you're going to get feedback from both sides of that. You know, you're going to get people who agreed one way or the other. If the show is a more kind of, I mean, frankly, if the show is more of just an interview style show, which we do from time to time, you don't tend to get as much feedback because people are more just listening to a regular interview, unless the person says something very contentious or something. But most of the time, yeah, it tends to be those cultural hot button issues that tend to provoke the most response, probably. When there's been a very sort of rancorous engagement between two people, that will generate response.
Oh, I'm sorry for not providing that for you,
well,
Justin.
I was looking for more drama, frankly, Matthew, on your episode than I got. But, or if people just think something was said that was plain wrong, then, you know, if there was a factual error on the show, you know, you'll get about five emails all saying the same thing. Oh, you got that wrong. But anyway, no, it's all good. I enjoy it all. I really do most of all enjoy getting feedback from the non-Christians, actually, who listen to the show, because A, I love the fact that there are non-Christians who listen to the show, and B, I want to know how the show is landing on that side of the fence, as it were. I don't just want to hear sort of, you know, people agreeing with the Christian. I want to hear the other side of that.
You know, one of the things, speaking of non-Christian feedback, the community that Matthew and I are part of, and you know some of the other folks, you know David Johnson and some of the other podcasters that we sort of
have. Ed,
Skydive Phil Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we miss is the discussion groups that were under each page on the Premier Christian Radio website for Unbelievable. So you'd put up one every Saturday. And we had a bit of a competition, to be honest, to see who could, we were practically sitting there pressing reload on the browser, right? Just waiting, waiting for the show to go live to see who could land the first comment.
First.
Right. And we would even claim right of supremacy some way to be the first one in. And we would even do, I'm not kidding now, we would even do things like prepare our comments ahead of time, you know, write them in Notepad or whatever, right? And have this whole comment ready. And then you'd have this fully fleshed out train of thought about the whole episode. We're just sitting there waiting to post these long comments, and the boards have gone away. They have.
I apologize for that. I mean, I can't remember when the decision was taken, but at some point it was decided that moderating a lot of these comments and things was going to be tricky. Yeah. Now I actually held on. I made an exemption. I asked for a specific exemption that I think lasted for at least a few years. But Unbelievable, because I was aware there was this quite vibrant chat community there, that people, regulars, let's say, who like to comment in, you know, on the chat. But even that eventually, unfortunately, had to go, partly because of logistical issues, but mainly because eventually they were going to be replacing the website as well. So unfortunately, yes, the chat community had the little community that did gather at the end of the webpage each week had to go. I mean, there are other ways, hopefully, that people are doing. Obviously, there continues to be a thriving conversation on the Unbelievable group on Facebook, where I know some of your members frequent. But yes, unfortunately, that particular little instantiation did come to an end. I can't remember exactly when, a couple of years ago, I think. So
on that subject, I'd like to do a quick shout out to the people who administer the unofficial Unbelievable Facebook group. They do a sterling job. It's hard work. I did spend a brief period of time assisting with the moderation of that a year ago, the amount of time required is more than I was able to provide. So my short stint was always going to end, and I'm quite happy about that. The people that do it do a much better job than I would be able to do. But all of those people, you know who you are if you're listening. Thank you. You do a great job.
They do. And there was a while where I was trying to kind of moderate that, and it just wasn't working because I didn't have the time. And I was so grateful when I was able to place it in the capable hands of a group of both Christian and non-Christian moderators who I think do a fabulous job of keeping order there. So, I've loved to see that it's continued to go on and thrive in many ways.
It is. So let's move on to some of the episodes that you've done, because you've done quite a number of episodes. I've got quite a few questions I want to ask about that. I'm just trying to work out which one I want to ask first. Lots of people will want to know if you have a favourite. I'm sure you've read, I think every year you do a blog post about the favourite ones of the year. So rather than a favourite per se, what are your standout episodes, ones that have taken you by surprise?
Yes, I always joke it's like asking me to choose between my children. But no, it's not.
I've got a perfect answer to that, Justin. Stick with one.
Stick with
then,
one.
Then you're perfectly okay to say, I have a favourite child. That's easy.
Very good. Very good. I never know what might be the next best show around the corner. So never say never. But just looking back over the last few years, you know, some of the standout ones have been, well, firstly, I was just so pleased to get last year Richard Dawkins and Francis Collins in conversation. I just really enjoyed being part of that. In some ways, they trod very familiar ground in terms of the types of conversation they were having. But it was just great to be able to get someone like Dawkins, who I'd had on in a different kind of capacity sometime before, but really in his own area of expertise, opposite obviously someone else who's a leader in his field in the area of genetics as a Christian. Yeah, so that was a real treat. Again, looking at the big conversation, which is this special set of episodes we do each year in partnership with John Templeton Foundation, one of the standouts for me was when I brought together Tom Holland and A.C. Grayling. I really enjoyed that debate. You know, interestingly, arguably, it wasn't a Christian versus non-Christian show in that instance, because Tom Holland, although I think he has, you know, significant leanings towards Christianity, he's not coming at his argument as a Christian necessarily, more as a historian. But they just had such a great high level dramatic interchange. A.C. Grayling defending his view of history and philosophy, and his view that obviously we don't really owe anything to Christianity in terms of our values and whatnot, and Tom Holland obviously having precisely the opposite view with his book Dominion. And it was just a very engaging and sparky debate, and it was just fun to be in the middle of that. And so that was a real treat as well. Really, really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, that one got more feisty than I expected it to when I started listening to it.
And to be honest, it did for me as well. It was almost, you could see Tom Holland sort of getting gradually, you know, more and more kind of frustrated with Grayling. And particularly the first sort of 20, 25 minutes is quite something to watch, as Tom and Anthony go head to head on the kind of specifics of whether the early Christians were responsible for ransacking, you know, early sort of ancient literature and classical civilization and so on. So that was a sort of a fun one as well. I guess some of the live shows, you know, where we've had an audience present have been a real treat as well. Really enjoyed hosting Ian McGilchrist and Sharon Dirks last year at the British Library for their conversation on mind and materialism. Not in a sense an adversarial debate in that case. You know, there were a lot of ways in which they were on the same page. But I really enjoyed kind of, well, partly probably it was more the fact that it was my first in-person show in a long time. And it was just nice to have two people sitting with me for that particular conversation. But likewise, I remember a very memorable one where John Lennox and Dave Rubin sat down together in, we did a show in the USA in California. And again, a very different kind of show, because they got on very well. And it felt like there was just a lot of openness from Dave Rubin, who in a sense was sitting on the secular side for that evening. But boy, he just seemed very open to issues of faith and whatnot. So it was just a very different kind of conversation. And that was quite refreshing. And so those, they're all different for different reasons, and why they, I suppose, lodge in my memory for all of those different reasons.
And in your humblest moments right at the beginning, when you were pitching this idea and doing those first shows, did you imagine that you would still be doing it 15 plus years later?
I guess I didn't even think about it. You know, I suppose at the time you just think whether this will work next week when you try it, and then whether you've got enough ideas, you know, to sustain it for a couple of months. But as I went on, you know, I quickly realized, you know, this whole area was huge, and that you know, potentially there was a bottomless well of ideas and topics and guests. And I think, in fact, because the whole area of Christian apologetics has grown, and in the time that I've been doing the show, it's actually meant that there's been an ever expanding number of people and topics and resources to draw upon. I mean, the show itself launched just at the time the new atheism was really picking up steam, and that in a way I think was fortunate, because that really gave it a momentum and an impetus. And very certainly, you know, in those first 5 or 6 years of the show, you know, new atheism sort of provided the grist for the mill to kind of keep turning, and there was always Richard Dawkins was bringing out a book, or there was some controversy happening here, there, or everywhere. And so because there was this kind of lively online atheist community that you could tap into, you know, there was lots of interesting subjects and people who you could bring on and then find an appropriate Christian opposite them. And likewise, Christian apologetics was starting to gear up in response at the same time. And you were starting to see some of these big figures like William Lane Craig throwing down the gauntlet to people like Richard Dawkins, and all of that sort of stuff made for great audio and radio and podcasting at the time. In some ways, we rode the wave of that in the first sort of 5 to 10 years, really, of the show. In a funny way, I think the new atheism thing has definitely calmed down a lot, and in a way is more in the back window now. And naturally, the show has probably moved on a bit from a lot of those just kind of atheist versus Christian type debates that we had at the beginning. We still have those, obviously, but it's probably a bit more varied now than it used to be on that respect.
At least in the United States, Christianity is finding itself in the rearview mirror.
Well, I'm not saying that non-belief is in the rearview mirror by any means. I just mean that the more kind of dogmatic sort of form of new atheism has sort of, I think, even in the US to some extent, gone to the wayside a bit. I think that it's been replaced by a different kind of conversation. Just so those sort of, you know, those well-known characters like Dawkins and co are not the kind of, don't have the cultural cachet they once had. And even a person like Sam Harris, who was one of the Four Horsemen, he sort of reinvented himself as a sort of meditation guru, culture warrior. He barely talks about religion anymore. So it just feels like that phenomenon kind of has tailed off in that sense.
I think it has. And in fact, I don't know if you follow the atheist community of Austin, the ACA, the atheist experience, but at least through loose connection, you'll know who they are, Matt Dillahunty and that crowd. And in fact, he just retired.
He just left the atheist community of Austin, didn't he? I understand there was a bit of a cloud over it. There was some, I think, fallouts and so on, but I don't know the details. But yeah,
I don't either.
All things come to an end, I suppose. But I do wonder whether it's possibly, you know, partly because the steam has slightly gone out of that movement a little bit. I think wherever there is strong religious right in America, you will find a kind of strong atheistic kind of response.
Yeah.
In a funny way, as religiosity itself declines, arguably, in the States, I think there's less reason for there to be a sort of strong anti-theistic kind of, you know, online thing, because it's perhaps not deemed so necessary. I don't know. I'm just speculating here, really. But
I agree, they sort of need each other, don't they?
I think that was right.
There's a sort of symbiotic relationship between the strong figures on both sides.
Indeed. Yeah. You need a Ted Haggard for every
the equal and opposite pressure. Yes.
Right.
I'll use that as a springboard just to jump onto a few questions, because I have got a lot of questions and I'm conscious of time and with the knowledge of not going through all the questions. In terms of the show, staying roughly on the subject of the shows you've done, and I discovered your podcast around about the time you were doing the Atheist Prayer Experiment, but I didn't listen to those episodes while the experiment was active. So by the time I realized it was going on, it was over. So the whole opportunity for me to think seriously about that was just gone. But I have had a question about that period of unbelievable history. And the question is basically, would you consider doing something like that again?
I'd certainly consider it. My main fear is you might feel like we're repeating ourselves a bit, because you know, it was a fun, novel thing to do at the time. And it was never, you know, very serious scientific experiment at the time even, but I wouldn't be against potentially doing it. I think in a way the audience for Unbelievable has only grown since the time that we did that, and we might find a lot more, you know, takers and maybe a more coherent, you know, more professional way of pulling it together. But it was a real fun thing to do. I honestly didn't expect many people to take part, but I think in the end we had, you know, 70 odd right. non-believers who signed up for this atheist prayer experiment. I don't think all that many of them sort of stayed the course, but it was interesting, you know, to get the stories and have the...
Because it was getting them to pray every day for 30 days or something like that.
40 days. I think it was 40. Days. We felt that was a suitably biblical
number. The Lent period.
Well, it wasn't done at Lent, but it was a number that, that is typically associated with things like Lent. And yeah, I think, you know, you may remember that the thing that sort of sparked the whole idea was Tim Mawson, who's a Christian philosopher in Oxford, had done this paper sort of saying, basically at a philosophical level, in a kind of Pascal's Wager kind of way, it makes sense for atheists to pray. They're better off covering the bases, as it were, and reaching out and just testing whether there's a God in prayer than not. And it was a kind of a fun philosophical paper, but I thought it was rather interesting. I thought, well, this could be the basis for actually putting this into practice. And so sort of in conjunction with Tim, I sort of said, why don't we try and give this, I've got atheist listeners to my show. They might be up for taking part in this. And so we put this call out and we managed to pull together, you know, this list of people who said they were up for it. And they kind of, I'm trying to recall it all now, but there was a little Facebook group where the members who were a part of it could feedback their experiences. They were asked to email me on a regular basis. I would sort of do a few video updates during the course of it. And it was all, you know, very interesting. And overall, the idea was, would they hear anything if an atheist genuinely asked every day for 40 days for God to reveal himself to them? What would the result be was simply the question. The results themselves, arguably, if you were kind of taking this seriously as a God test, were not very much in the favor of theism, because, well, for those who did complete it, and we were obviously just having to take their word for it that they did what they said they did, the majority said they didn't think they felt anything. You know, no.
Seems
no
like answer. You had two responses that were out of the time limit or something like that.
Yeah, and then, so this was the funny thing, was that there were two people who, as it were, in the whole process, did come to faith, interestingly, who said they weren't Christians before they took part. But interestingly, they did just fall outside specifically this 40-day period. So I think in both cases, they decided to take part, thinking that they were going to take part, but then they had... something happened. So in the case of one of them, I think they started praying before the 40-day period officially began. And they just immediately decided they believed. It was like suddenly the lights came on and they were like, yeah, this makes sense. I think I am a Christian. And the other person was pregnant at the time and went to have her child shortly before, as I say, the period began. And it was, again, story may get mixed up in my head, but it was something to do with having this baby and seeing a double rainbow in the sky, something again clicked, and they said, yeah, I think I believe in God. Interestingly, neither of those actually fell within this 40-day window, so sort of had to be excluded, strictly speaking, from the results. But I said in my book, maybe that's, if you look at it from a Christian perspective, God's sense of humour, trying to co-opt
God. Well, he clearly doesn't abide by human, the concept of time anyway, so...
Well, that's my excuse anyway.
I think that's fine. You know. I think the folks here, Still Unbelievable, would love to partner in that. Let's do a counter-experiment.
Well, maybe we could do it. Right. Maybe we could give it a try.
Let's have 40 or 50 Christians that decide to live as skeptics for 40 days and find...
Okay.
Although I suspect the folks at Premier Christian Radio might not have you.
it's interesting, because if you did try to reverse the experiment in that way, I mean, how would you do it? Because it's one thing to ask a skeptic to just ask, you know, put a prayer out there and say, God, if you're there, I'm open. I'm trying to be as open as I can be. Now, if you're asking a Christian to try and, how do you put it, live as a skeptic for 40 days, well, what would that mean? Would it just mean they stopped doing Christian things? They kind of stopped praying, stopped going to church, tried not to think about God. What would that actually be, Andrew, in your mind?
I think that's a good question. I guess church would, I don't know if church would be in or out. And in the same way, I would say this about a prayer experiment. I'm not actually sure what qualifies as success in a prayer experiment. So seeing a double rainbow doesn't strike me as success for believing in God.
Well, no. For me, it was evidence that different people will have very different standards of what, you know, what strikes them. I mean, you know,
right,
the fact is that the most Christians, frankly, don't arrive at their beliefs through some super rational process. In fact, I think most of us in all areas of life probably don't arrive the way we think because of that. So I don't know but carry on. I interrupted your thoughts.
Oh, no. Look, this is just, we're just kicking the can. So maybe not going to church for 40 days, although a lot of Christians have, they've experienced that just in the last 2 years because of the whole COVID thing. But I think, you know, one of the things you could ask them to do that would parallel the atheist prayer experiment is to simply say, over the next 40 days, when you encounter something where you think God might have intervened, now, I don't want to trivialize it by giving any examples. So whatever the person thinks God intervened in, no matter how big or how small, right, to ask them to search for an alternative answer that didn't include God intervening. And I think that sort of thought experiment is what is really being asked of a skeptic that participates in the prayer experiment, if you see what I mean. So you're saying to a skeptic that's participating in the prayer experiment, well, ask for God to reveal himself to you. Well, the sort of natural opposite of that would be to say to Christians, live for the next 40 days as if there is no God. And I'm not saying they can't go to church, because I realize how important that is on other levels, right? But you can say, rather than attributing an intervention to God, do the research to see if there's an alternative answer. Those things seem to be very parallel in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is, Andrew, that it would depend to some extent on the Christian, because there might be Christians who, you know, on a daily basis attribute all kinds of things to divine intervention. I'm not one of them. Very rarely do I have an experience where I say, well, God was definitely behind that. Now, in a sense, I have a general belief that God's behind everything, you know,
sure,
be it a strange occurrence or a perfectly normal one. For the most part, most things I do attribute in a sense to natural cause, you know, means. I don't sort of, if I run into an old friend on the street, I don't immediately think God set me up here to run into this. I just think, oh, I ran into so and so. I just suspect different Christians might not be that far off what you're describing already. It's just that the way they kind of understand the way God does speak to them, so on, it isn't necessarily through spooky coincidences. It's maybe different sorts of things. But I, in a way, I think it's a good thing. I mean, I think too often Christians are a bit too credulous or tend to sort of be too quick to sort of see spooky stuff happening, when actually we should be looking for all the options on the table for why something happened, and shouldn't immediately jump to some sort of divine conclusion in that way. My next question to you, though, Andrew, what would be evidence that naturalism is more likely on the basis of this experiment? What would it be that people just started to act in a way where they didn't no longer attributed things to God? That would be proof that it's more likely that naturalism is true. I'm not sure how you would sort of quantify this experiment in the end.
Well, yeah, I think the problem is the same on the other end. How do you quantify that you know, the double rainbow can be attributed to God, right? But I think that's a good question. How do we report the results is a critical question. So one of the possible responses from a participant would be, my instinct at some point in time during the experiment was to attribute a pay raise to God intervening on my behalf. Okay. Hopefully that's not too trivial. I'm trying to pick something that somebody would care about, or they, you know, they found a new place to live that was a better school system for their children, something that people really sink their teeth into.
Yeah.
And as they do that, as they sort of have that normal attribution that they might have toward God, they decide to dig in and discover that actually, you know, it doesn't seem that God intervened at all. And so the interesting report would be, as I looked into the things that I previously thought were interventions from God over the course of the experiment, I didn't actually find anything that I could directly attribute to God, right? That would be one interesting result if it happened.
Yeah.
Another interesting result would be, well, I still had these things that I attributed to God, but I had some other things that I discovered I couldn't attribute to God. So it is now harder for me to tell when God is intervening in my life because I'm not as good a judge establishing divine intervention as I thought I was. That's another possible kind of result. I wouldn't want to spoil the experiment by suggesting those things up front, if we actually got started with it. But I do think that there are some quite interesting possible outcomes.
Yeah.
That would be parallel, but mirrors skeptics who found faith. I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's obvious that some Christians do lose their faith, a la Matthew Taylor and Andrew Knight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting idea. I mean, just to kind of go back to the original atheist prayer experiment. Apart from those two we mentioned where people came to faith, there were still interesting results. Apart from, I just didn't hear anything. There were a number of people who said something happened. So a lot of people said, even though I didn't attribute it to God, I felt a sense of peace. I really enjoyed that time. I ended up, using this to kind of meditate and to kind of, for a bit of introspection or whatever. So there were people who obviously felt that. There was one person in particular who said they heard an audible voice, or a voice in their head, at least, I should say. I can't remember what it exactly was now. But again, it was meaningful for that person in that moment of prayer when they heard this voice. But again, in the end, they didn't attribute it to God. They felt this was kind of something within themselves kind of coming out, perhaps deep down and so on. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because if a Christian heard an atheist say, well, I heard a voice when I prayed and it really helped me, the Christian might be saying, well, there's your evidence, it's at least one positive result. But again, it's down to the individuals. Whereas one person can interpret a double rainbow and say, I believe in God. Another person can hear a voice while they pray and say, I'm still an atheist. So there's a sort of, so much is actually ultimately about the individual themselves and what they're willing to interpret as evidence for or against. And I suspect the same will be true if the boot were on the foot and it was Christians trying to sort of be as atheistic as possible in a sense. The only other issue I see as well with inverting the experiment that way is, whereas it was, I think, relatively easy to kind of get atheists on board for this, to say, it's a bit of fun, why not, give it a try, what's there to lose kind of thing. I think it would be much harder to convince Christians to sort of stop doing the things that they genuinely believe are healthy for them and kind of keep them in touch with God and say, just tried not doing it, because it would feel very wrong, almost morally wrong, I think, for a lot of Christians. So I think you'd have trouble getting the Christians on board for that one, if that makes sense. It's a bit harder to kind of do it the other way around, if that makes sense.
I get that and I understand that. And I think that was one of my issues with the prayer experiment. And I had some kind of conversation about this when Andrew and I did the Alpha course, and that the Alpha course went online in 2020, and we attended that and reviewed it over several episodes. And one of the conversations I had in the group about that kind of thing, about prayer and getting an answer, was I said back, I am prepared to do that, but it comes with a condition. If nothing happens, then I need you to accept that that is a negative result and your belief is wrong and you need to abandon the belief. And the response was, no, that would never happen. That can't happen. And I said, well, you've lined it up so that you always win. And I said, I can't prevent it. It has to go both ways. And that was the challenge in that conversation. And that's probably one of the reasons why I wouldn't have taken part.
Okay.
Although that's my thinking now. I hadn't matured that kind of thinking then. But the other reason why I think I would not have taken part was I was at the tail end of 3 years of deconstruction, where I'd prayed not necessarily every day, but certainly a significant number of days throughout that period and got nothing. And I'd got to the point where the futility of that seeking had become painful. So why would I now submit myself to another 40 days? As a just in case, if God was that interested in me, he'd have turned up by now.
I totally get that, and I can perfectly see the reasons why it didn't make sense, and there would have been a cost in a sense to doing that. I also understand, that it's, I get that objection you have, that tails I win, heads you lose with prayer, because it's always the Christian can always say, if someone doesn't think they heard anything, well, maybe you weren't praying right, maybe you weren't really open, maybe that's just not the way God's going to communicate with you. So I understand that frustration. At the same time, I think it would be a mistake, and I hope no one ever really took it away from this thing, that I genuinely saw this as a sort of test of theism. I think it was an interesting kind of social experiment more than a kind of genuine sort of test for whether theism is true. So I think for the individual, if they know that they have genuinely prayed and, as far as they're aware, has been as open as they possibly could be and taken part in good faith in this experiment and yet heard nothing back, I think it is legitimate for that individual to then say, well, there's at least one piece of evidence against God. I'm not going to stand here and say we can sort of put God to that test, that there's a sort of, that, you know, if there is a God, that somehow God is required to submit to such standards of evidence or something. But I can understand fully why, from that person's perspective, as someone who doesn't believe in God and has thinks they have genuinely tried to open themselves up, why they would be able to say, no, actually, I think in that case, at least in this particular instance, I've let slightly less reason now to believe in God. And that was ultimately what Tim Mawson was saying. You know, this will either confirm or disconfirm your you know, belief in God. And that's fine. That's kind of was the purpose of the whole thing. So, so I get why you would have been frustrated by that sort of an answer on the course, Matthew.
And just to tie up the conversation on the experiment, there's too much subjectivity involved, and I don't know how one could possibly eliminate that. And I think the podcast medium just makes it extra hard. To try to make it scientific.
Absolutely. As I say, this was not a scientific experiment by any stretch of the imagination. There was no control. There was no, and if there is a God, that's one sort of variable you cannot account for anyway. So it's a sort of, it was more a kind of fun social kind of experiment rather than anything very, scientific in any way.
Okay. So sticking roughly to that subject, though, I'm going to assume now, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to assume that you've changed over the last 15 years in which you've been doing Unbelievable, changed in your outlook. Maybe some of the Christian beliefs that you hold have changed over that time. Are there any that have changed directly as a result of the conversations you have on Unbelievable, and are you prepared to talk about them?
Yes, is the short answer to all of them. I'm happy to. I mean, there were things when I started that show that I'd never really even thought about. I didn't really have a view on things, and I gradually started to put pieces together and sort of start to put things into perspective, so that I did have an idea of where I fell on a particular issue. So at the point where I started the show, to take something like the issue of evolution and creation, I kind of vaguely believed, I think, that there was probably an evolutionary process, but I really hadn't looked into it much. And by the time, you know, you've done 17 whatever years of doing the show, and you've done quite a lot of discussions around that whole area, you do come away with a sort of, you know, probably a place you land at. Now, I'm not saying I have actually, even at this point, a very defined kind of thing, because it's one of those issues where I don't think you have to have it all nailed down in order to be a Christian by any means. But I have a perspective on that has come out of all of those years of being able to be part of those conversations on Adam and Eve and creation and evolution and intelligent design and everything else. I mean, one example where, you know, I mentioned this in my book that came out a few years ago, where I certainly had a kind of change of doctrine in the course of doing the show, was I probably went into the show more or less kind of holding to the view of hell that I'd sort of been taught, you know, in the church that I grew up in, which was, I wouldn't have used this terminology because I only learned it once I started doing the show, but what people would call eternal conscious torment, the view that hell is a place of everlasting sort of punishment. And then I started to engage, you know, on the show with these different perspectives, that there was also this annihilationist perspective, and there was also this universalist perspective, you know, that a number of Christians hold, that ultimately everyone will be won over by the love of God and so on. And yeah, and I think I kind of, you know, after hearing a number of different perspectives on that and some cogent cases, I kind of finally arrived at, and I'm still comfortable with, the position that I essentially hold to an annihilationist position, that, which for those who aren't familiar with it, is just that there's a final end to those who ultimately reject God, that there isn't a kind of endless, you know, place of punishment for those, but rather that, I think, on the balance of evidence, I think the Bible actually talks about a final end, a sort of, for the state of those who are kind of choose not to follow God. And that kind of makes more sense to me at a sort of moral level as well, I think, than it never quite struck White that there would always be a place of people who are in constant rebellion and punishment in God's new creation. That just didn't make sense to me, that there could still be such a place. And it didn't make sense to me that this idea that the act of rebelling against God justified a kind of an eternity of punishment either. The punishment didn't seem to fit the crime, as it were. So so for me, you know, I landed both for biblical and for sort of philosophical reasons on a kind of annihilationist perspective. To be honest, though, I hope I'm wrong. I hope universalists are right. I hope everyone makes it in the end. I'd be absolutely delighted if that were the case. I don't hold to that doctrine because, in a sense, my preferred one, it's because it seems to make most sense of the evidence I see around me and the fact that people do hold out against God, you know, and won't potentially always be won over. I don't see that there's evidence that they would. But if it turned out that everyone went the Rob Bell way, as it were, and got it and were won over by the love of God, and that the universalists were right after all, that would be amazing.
So, I ask you, you said, in essence, that there were, you know, people who chose not to believe. And it's an interesting sort of phrase to me, because I am not sure that I choose my beliefs in the way that sounded like it was meant. So not ascribing to you what is in my head, but I am interested in your thoughts here. Because when I was a Christian, and I was a Christian for a long time, one of my majors in college was theology. I was serious about being a Christian. There was not a day in my walk as a Christian where I suddenly chose not to believe. Lost my Christianity was that there were things that I found inconsistent about my belief versus how the world works. And as a result of some painstaking reflection and some real grief and some loss of social connections and some real penalties associated with no longer being a Christian in the community I was a part of, I had to walk away because my internal landscape no longer matched with Christianity. But there was not a day where I thought, you know what, I'm just not having fun anymore, and so I'm not going to be a Christian when I wake up tomorrow morning or whatever, right? I didn't choose to disbelieve. So I'm not trying to paint you with some sort of unfriendly brush here, but my walk away from Christianity didn't happen that way. And I'm not sure that we choose our beliefs in the way that Christianity typically suggests, that there are people on Judgment Day and some are on the left and some are on the right, and the ones on the left chose to disbelieve. And so I'm curious about your thoughts then. And sorry for the monologue.
No, that's fine. I think you're right at one level, that there is a sense in which, to some extent, beliefs aren't something we choose. They sort of they come to us, don't they? They're sort of what we have to go with. You know, it's a bit like saying today I will choose to prefer strawberry over chocolate ice cream or something. You know, right. It's not something you can choose in a sense. It's something that just is. You know, and to some extent I can see the way that the beliefs can function like that. I think perhaps when I'm using Christian belief, we're using a shorthand for something that's more than just about, you know, making logical connections that sort of make sense rationally. I think, you know, faith perhaps is a better term, although often a contested term itself, because in the end, for me, your standing before God is not just about whether you were able in the end to adopt a certain set of beliefs in that sense, a certain set of assent to a certain set of statements, you know, about the reality of the world. I think a lot of people spend a lot of time doubting, a lot of Christians spend a lot of time doubting things, not believing things the whole time in that sense. But they trust. There's a kind of sense that they've just decided almost, you know, to trust in God. They're kind of going to stick with God. They're going to carry on seeking and searching and trusting in God, despite the fact that they don't always feel like they believe something very much. I know that's been the testimony of many people I've spoken to who have gone through seasons of doubt. And so for me, faith in God is about more than just whether, you know, at this point I can logically assent to such and such a belief. It's more about a kind of a totality of your heart and your head. And so that's to some extent why when I say, you know, for those in the end who decide not to follow Jesus, I'm talking about more than just who in the end decided they couldn't logically believe in Christianity. And I suppose in the end, because I do believe that there's an issue of the heart and the will and something much deeper that in a sense only God ultimately can see and judge, there are going to be people in the end who don't want God, if that makes sense. I genuinely believe there are people who are resistant, who don't want to have anything bigger than themselves potentially in their lives, and who, even if they were in that sense confronted with God on the last day, would not want what's on offer. And for me, that's the kind of vision of heaven I have. If there is a vision of heaven and hell in my head, it's something to do with the idea that not everyone wants to be ruled by a king in a kingdom. And that goes beyond just whether we've sort of decided Christianity makes logical sense or not. It's a matter of the heart. I don't know if this is helping at all, Andrew, but that's kind of, I guess I'm just saying it's bigger than just sort of, you know, that bare idea of belief in that sense.
Sure. Well, it helps me understand where you are. I think for me, just to reply, just to respond to that a little bit, I neither want or deny a God. As far as I can tell, the ones that have been offered to me are not ones that I accept on the basis of the evidence. But part of my rejection of Christianity has to do with following Jesus, if I understood how you are using that phrase. So here's what I mean. As you know, the United States has a much more conservative version of Christianity than you guys in the UK do. And there are things about Christianity here in the United States that I reject as loudly as I can reject it, because I think that if there were a God out there, what he most likely wants for human beings is not being pursued by the kind of Christianity that you very often see here. But more than that, and much more importantly, the way that I make decisions today is, well, this will be something you're familiar with, the terms pro-social or anti-social, right? Mm. And the decisions that I make aren't made out of the pages of the New Testament. They're made out of a decision to be pro-social, and by pro-social in this sense, I mean things that we can all pretty objectively agree on are likely to benefit the most people without harming others. And my problem with Christianity is that is not how I often see it practiced. In fact, it's not even how I see it talked about. Mm. It's I must align my will with God regardless of the consequences. And I reject that notion. And if that means that I'm not, you know, if I somehow line up on the left in some judgment day, I would be willing to accept that.
Yeah. And forgive me if I'm misrepresenting anything you said here, Andrew, and feel free to correct me. At one level, I want to say, firstly, there are many forms of Christianity, cultural instantiations of Christianity that we may reject, and yet not necessarily be rejecting God or Christ in the process, because, you know, you may be exposed to all kinds of toxic forms of Christianity, which quite rightly you've said, no, this is not good for me or for culture or whatever. To that extent, I wouldn't want to equate belief in God and, you know, being a Christ follower with whatever specific version of Christianity you have encountered and which you have found actually unhelpful or wrong. By the same token, I would say, given that you find yourself in a position where you find it more beneficial now to live by this sort of pro-social rule than by any sort of Christian creed that, you know, you had when you were a Christian, my perhaps slightly controversial suggestion to you is that you're still essentially living out of a Christian worldview in doing that, because your pro-social inclination is arguably very much shaped by the Judeo-Christian Western world in which those kind of humanist principles have been established. So I, on the one hand, I want to say rejecting certain cultural forms of Christianity doesn't necessarily mean you've rejected God or Christ necessarily. And secondly, I think it's hard to actually escape the fact that even our most humanistic sort of, you know, moral systems are really quite Christian in nature.
I think that's a correlation versus, this is going to sound more combative than I really wanted to, but that sounds like a correlation versus causation fallacy to me. And so I'll tell you why. It may very well be that I support LGBTQI plus rights, right? And it may very well be that there are groups of Christians that do too, but we don't support them for the same reason. A Christian that looks at the New Testament and comes to the conclusion that they can support, either side A or side B, LGBTQI plus rights, comes to it through the lens of the New Testament. That is not how I come to it. The New Testament isn't involved in that thinking at all. I get there through the lens of understanding that human sexuality and human gender are not the same thing. And the Bible doesn't have anything to say about, you know, people with XXY chromosome pairing or XYY chromosome pairing or whatever reinforces their ultimate decision about what gender they identify as and what partner they want later in life. So I come to my support through something that has nothing to do with the New Testament. That might very well be that we come to the same conclusion. But the fact that we come to the same conclusion doesn't mean that I'm living out some sort of Christian ideal, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think I'm almost taking a step back from just saying, what do you read off the pages of the New Testament about sexuality and gender? And I'm saying, actually, so I'm making a bit of a Tom Hollandish-ish argument here. And I'm saying the very society in which we value individual rights and freedom of expression in such a way that goes along with the increasing kind of values, the rights we've given to people to self-determine in terms of sexuality and gender and everything else, are very arguably a specific product of the Judeo-Christian heritage. Now, they're not an obvious product. They're not something you would read necessarily off the pages of scripture, but they are very much tied to the idea of every human being having intrinsic value and dignity. And it's out of that tradition, which is a Judeo-Christian tradition, which is alien to the vast majority of the rest of the ancient world in which it came from, and indeed to many parts of the world today. It's only really in Western Christian heritage countries that you find these particular ideals. That is the cradle within which you can have an LGBTQI movement. Now, again, so this is the reason why Tom Holland even says you can only be an atheist today because of Christianity, because there was a kind of a framework that gave you to move in that direction, to have this, the right. So I'm kind of taking a step back even from the Bible and saying, I think we underestimate just how much everything, even our ability to be an atheist and to call ourselves secular, is actually a fruit of the Christian revolution. So, yeah, that's all I'm saying, Andrew, is if you had arguably been a rationalist in ancient Greece, you wouldn't necessarily have this pro-social thing. It's a very Christian instinct to want the best for every individual because you believe everyone's having this intrinsic value that means that we should treat them in, you know, with equality and dignity and everything else. It's not a view that the ancients held. It's not a view that many people in other parts of the world hold today.
Can I jump in on this one, Andrew?
Please. I hope you're going to say something about egalitarianism in other societies.
Well, only tangentially, because I'm conscious of time and the subject matter that we've covered. I would like to push back a little bit on that and point out that Christianity itself is a product of the culture and the environment in which you grew up. You know, culture and society didn't start at Christianity. There were things that predated Christianity, and Christianity itself is built on that. So I don't think Christianity can claim the exclusive rights and the exclusive benefits of all of that. But more to the point, since me being openly atheist, the worst comments, the worst things that I get, and yes, admittedly, it's online, and yes, admittedly, online, it tends to be the noisiest people. But so much of the Christian pushback I get is vile. I get horrid things said to me. And one of the saddest experiences I've had here at Still Unbelievable was when I invited Steve Chalk to come on to Still Unbelievable back at the beginning of 2020, I think it was. Angela, I had a fabulous conversation with Steve Chalk. In fact, I will say Steve Chalk is probably my favourite Christian. I adore the man. He's brilliant. But when I see some of the things that other Christians say about him, they say things about him that they also say about me. You know, that person was never saved and worse. And this kind of comment is so ubiquitous. And so Christianity for me, since I've left Christianity, has given me a real jaundiced view of itself, because the noise that I see from Christianity is very, very narrow and very, very competitive and very, very exclusive. And all these things that you've been talking about seeing other people equal, doesn't exist in so many of the comments that I see. And it's deeply saddening to see.
I'm very sad to hear that as well, Matthew. And I can only say I'm glad you don't judge all Christians by the ones.
I know better that I'm married to a lovely Christian, so I can't judge all Christians that way.
I agree with you. I'm not going to try and defend the actions of Christians who just are ungracious and unkind. And even if you disagree with Steve Chalk, which you're welcome to do if you're a Christian, that doesn't mean that you slander or name call or whatever. So we're on the same page there. I absolutely agree. Christians do not cover themselves with glory a lot of the time. And they give people lots of reasons to think, well, I'm better off not being a Christian. So, yeah, it's a sad reality of the fact. Having said all that, for me, it doesn't take away from the fact that actually so much of what we do believe in the West about human equality, dignity, values and so on does actually come directly from the Christian Revolution. Now, you're absolutely right. Christianity itself didn't come out of a vacuum. And of course, the primary thing it was based on was Judaism. And I would not at all exclude Judaism as having had an important, you know, very significant underpinnings of what Christians went on to build. So the doctrine of the equality of human, you know, the dignity and equality of human beings, I think stems from the first page of Genesis when humans were made in God's image. I think that underwrites the value of humans, and it's very hard and really underwrites, you know, and you can trace a line from Genesis through to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I think it's as simple as that. That's not to say that the other pagan cultures of the time, the Greeks and the Romans and everyone else, didn't have things to add and important contributions. But again, if you read a book like Dominion or there's a kind of simpler version of it called The Air We Breathe by Glenn Scrivener that I highly recommend, those kinds of books have really opened my eyes to the ways in which actually it was Christianity that really sent it global, in a sense, that really took those Jewish ideas and the way in which our culture now really has, you know, those ideas didn't come out of a vacuum. They came out from a very specific Christian heritage, I think is very hard to argue against.
Well, I would like to push back a little bit on specifically on the International Declaration of Human Rights. I can't remember which presidential wife it was that triggered off that, but I believe it was the wife of one of the US presidents, possibly Mrs. Roosevelt. But I have to check that and put a link in the show notes. But my understanding of when that was set up was it was specifically set up to include as many of the world religions and non-religions as possible. So it wasn't an exclusively Christian undertaking. It involved all faiths and no faiths and all cultures to try to bring something that could be as universal as possible. So it stings a bit to see Christians claiming credit for it.
Well, it purposely avoided religious language because it was very specifically setting out to try and be something that united people across all faiths and none. But the very act of declaring that humans have rights and that they exist in these inalienable rights to freedom and liberty, you know, and education and, you know, and all the things that enshrined, for me, that didn't come from naturalism, didn't come from atheism, didn't come from science. None of those things in any way lead you to the conclusion that humans have inalienable rights. But they do from a Christian perspective. And having said all that as well, the framers of, you know, some of the people involved really at the core of framing it, like Charles Malik and others, were very much influenced by their Christian faith and by social Catholic teaching and that kind of thing. So the UDHR, yes, it is framed as a secular document, but at its heart, I think it comes out of its Judeo-Christian heritage. It just is a product of that, as far as I'm concerned.
Don't you think, though, it's no big surprise, and it's pretty well publicized that the U.S. is in the midst of a lot of turmoil in regard to human rights right now? And don't you think that it's the Christians who are trying to drag us backward? That is certainly what I see in the papers. When we talk about right to reproductive health care in the United States, it is a largely Catholic Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade here in the United States. It is largely Christians who don't want LGBTQI plus rights in the United States. It is largely Christians who are trying to push a specific version of Christianity into schools. And so if it is a Judeo-Christian ethic that got us here, at least in the United States, it's a Judeo-Christian ethic that's trying to take it away.
The problem is, when we talk about the US and many parts of the world now, the culture wars have developed to a point where different types of rights are now bumping up against each other. You know, you talk about the issue of Roe versus Wade and so on. Obviously, as far as the Christians who are arguing from a pro-life perspective, they believe there's another right at stake apart from the right of a woman over her own body, and that is the right of the child, as they believe exists in the womb, to have the right to life. So I wouldn't say it's all about Christians wanting to roll back rights. It's about defining those rights and which rights trump other rights in that sense. And likewise with LGBT rights, you know, again, I don't know that many Christians who want to kind of, I'm sure they do exist, but who want to criminalize homosexuality. But there are those who obviously feel that the introduction of gay marriage and so on was somehow bad for culture, bad for society in what ways, and therefore there are rights of there are other kinds of rights that are being squashed by those. I'm not going to get into the specifics of those. All I'm saying is that just having the concept of rights, if you think there are such a thing as specific rights that humans have just by virtue of being human, you're basically saying something quite Christian at that point. Now, we can argue about what those rights are, who has them, who doesn't, in what case they apply or not, and whether Christians are the ones who are rolling them back. But at the end of the day, the bigger point I'm just making is that the very concept of human rights basically comes from a Christian foundation. I accept you disagree with that, Andrew and Matthew, to some extent, but where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I get it. And that was actually what I was pushing back on. We did find the line of disagreement. I think that extending to other people the right to act on their own is not a particularly Christian value. And while I do recognize that some societies are better at it than others, I don't think that we got here because Christianity said we should give everyone rights. And in the counterexamples, the approach seems to be, oh, well, right, we had these rights, but now, Christians didn't agree that those should have ever been rights to begin with, so somehow they get a pass. I don't think we get to play it both ways. Either Christianity is responsible for giving us this idea that humans have the right to act in their own best interest, or it didn't. In these specific cases, where we're talking about women's reproductive health, which is partly Roe v. Wade, but not only Roe v. Wade, we talk about LGBTQI+, we talk about the right for other religions to put their monuments side by side with Christian monuments in public schools in the United States. Those sorts of rights that you would say that we got here through Judeo-Christian value.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't, right? Because it's the Judeo-Christians that are fighting it.
No, I'm not saying Christians are always consistent at all in what rights they choose to defend, you know, and they may, you're absolutely right. I think there is an inconsistency when Christians are demanding that their Christian monuments be respected, and but that, you know, other faiths are not. You know, if we live in a culture where we're, you know, we have freedom of religion and freedom of thought, then if you're going to put up your Ten Commandments, then first you need to give space for the Muslim to put up their version. Having said all this, all I'm saying is, again, returning to Roe versus Wade, what you term reproductive health, the rights of reproductive health, another person will term the right of someone to kill a child. So it's all about the way you look at and interpret those rights as to what kind of right you're talking about in that case. And obviously, likewise with LGBTQ, though there are certain types of rights that are contested because certain people have different views on what actually constitutes. Now, the point is that I still think you only get an LGBT rights movement from a Christian culture. Go to the Muslim world. Where is the LGBT rights movement? It doesn't exist there. Go to China. Where is the LGBT rights movement? It doesn't exist there. It's been able to develop because we believe in the right of self-determination, which has come, I believe, from our Christian past, even though it's led us off into places where now certain Christians now, you know, vehemently disagree with those particular rights. It is still a product of Western Christian countries. I just think that's, you know, uncontroversial, really.
And so I think the controversy is, how do we determine what a right is?
I have, Justin, been asked to bring up the subject of deconstruction in this topic. We haven't got many, and I would love to see you do some episodes touch on. I know you've had Joel, and I can't remember the lady who does the Side B podcast. I know you had them on doing a show as well. I would love to see you having a discussion about deconstruction, the experiences of deconstruction. We have a lovely Facebook group here in the UK for Exvangelicals, which is, it's a great support group with some lovely people on it, looking after each other, well administered. And but some of the experiences of deconstruction, even in the UK, which is a much softer Christian country compared to some of the other cultures around the world, some of the experiences of people leaving Christianity are terrible and full of fear. And even in my own experience as well, even being married to somebody who is not a fundamentalist Christian, that fear of what happens to your dearest, most intimate relationship when you dare to come out as a non-believer, there is so much fear that is impackaged around leaving faith that Christianity subconsciously needles into you, whether intentional or not. That there is so much problematic that happens around deconstruction. Earlier, you and Andrew had the brief discussion about choice and things like that. And my experience is not unique. There are other people who've had very similar experiences to myself. That whole experience of trying to find God, trying to love God and getting nothing back, and that prolonged worry and fear of being let down, and fear of not doing it right, it goes on for so long, it becomes trauma, and which is why we now have the phrase religious trauma belt. And we have so many people who experience that kind of thing deeply and painfully. So to be told by another Christian that what we've done is a choice to reject God, etc., simply adds more pain to what is already a deeply painful and traumatic experience. So my one plea to any Christian that listens to this is, don't frame deconstruction and deconversion as a choice, because you're already causing pain into a conversation that you don't want to inject further pain into. Because there was at my lowest point, and again, it's not unique to me, at my lowest point, it wasn't me choosing, it was me feeling rejected by God. And when you spend all your formative years and a significant chunk of your adult years worshipping and loving God, and then you reach this point where actually you feel and then believe, not out of choice, that God has rejected you and wants nothing to do with you, it's hard to express suitably how low and despondent that feeling is. So for any Christian to frame it as a choice is hard.
I can imagine it's almost like going through the stages of grief, you know.
It is absolutely a grief experience, Justin. It genuinely is.
Yeah. And I hope, you know, I probably don't always choose my words very carefully, but I hope I wouldn't come across as in any way belittling that process or demeaning it, because I know the anguish that so many people who've been on that journey have gone through, and it is not something they've decided on lightly. On the contrary, it's taken often years, you know, kicking and screaming almost to sort of be dragged out of that. So yeah, my heart goes out to you, Matthew, for the difficulty and the pain and the anguish, and obviously the words that are often said which only serve to cause more of that. I suppose what I'm fascinated to know, Matthew, is why does this sort of thing help? Does running a podcast like Still Unbelievable, where you're kind of obviously kept in contact with these issues and so on, you're still thinking about it, talking it through, you know, looking into the evidence for faith, even if you're not convinced in any way. I suppose I wonder why, given that you have gone through such a painful journey, why do you kind of even keep in the orbit of these kinds of subjects and things? Why don't you just say, I'm done, you know, I'm going to go and take up calligraphy or something?
It's not for me. Is the first answer to that question, Justin. As I said when I was on your show briefly, I didn't choose to do this. Somebody thought I would be good at it and that I love it. But I don't do it primarily for me. Mm-hmm. Although there is a little bit of an ego part in it, but I'll try to minimize that as much as I can. What I am acutely aware of, so moving in these circles, is there are many people leaving Christianity going through that same experience. And Andrew and I get occasional contact and emails from people in those saying how they appreciate that we're a voice.
Yeah.
And so it's not me that I'm doing it for. I'm doing it for them. And, you know, as in those early years of my deconstruction, there were blogs. That was the big thing. And I read loads of blogs and read all the experiences of people blogs. I got very involved in a blogging community and I still have a blog that sits out there amongst that. And of course, then the podcasting came along and yours was very, very early on there. And it was useful then listening to you and Nick that for me to engage in podcasting as a podcaster then would have been the wrong thing for me to do. But I certainly did a lot of listening to other people's podcasts. And it was that helped me navigate to be the person that I am now. And that is why I continue doing it here for those people to give them a voice. I never expected it, but the Alpha Review episodes that we did continue to be quite popular and we get feedback on those and people consume those and appreciate our experience of going through Alpha and reviewing those. And we occasionally get comments, emails from us, from people who've listened to those. I never expected that. So which is why we've tried to do a few other review type shows, because clearly that kind of thing is appreciated because people want to hear a different perspective. People have come to these things with doubts and they consume some Christian content and they have their doubts, but they don't know how to express them. And then they go and listen to us or other podcasts doing that. And it puts things into a different perspective for them. And people appreciate that. So that's why I do it. The deconstructed community is full of hurting people and hurt people. And it needs mature people who've been through it to help them out and to talk to them and to tell them that there is still life after faith and to answer them questions, because intimate relationships are a terrible cost in this space. The attrition of marriages is quite significant. And so many people come in, and I'm glad that there are other people who are around to help those people. So that's why I'm here, that's why I'm in this space. But it's not for me.
Well, I appreciate that answer, and I think, you know, I'm glad that you're there to help those who are trying to navigate it. Obviously, we have featured deconstruction episodes of one form or another, but every single story is different. And I find personally, those are the most challenging stories. Those are always the most challenging guests from a non-Christian perspective to bring on, are the ones who were Christians, you know, and who are now ex-Christians, because it's much harder to say to them, well, you just haven't tried it. You know, you should do an atheist prayer experiment. They have tried it, and they were, the vast majority of the cases, as far as I'm concerned, genuine, you know, devout Christians, but for whatever reason things started not to make sense, they fell apart. And I think it's easier in a sense for me to pitch a kind of hard bitten, never really believed Richard Dawkins type against a Christian apologist than it is someone like you, Matthew, or Ed Atkinson, or whoever, who, you know, has been part of that community. They know it, they've been on the inside, as it were, and they genuinely did thought at one time they had a relationship with God, because I think that is harder to engage. Now, obviously, I come at this as a Christian, and I do believe there is a God. I do believe in Jesus, and I do believe that ultimately the door is always open in some way. And I have heard plenty of stories of Christians who have lost faith and come back to faith, often a very different kind of faith, maybe, than the one they perhaps rejected or lost. But I hope it would never stop me from treating those who don't go on that journey with compassion and respect and dignity that they deserve, as people who have not come to the same conclusions as me. I believe ultimately in a God who is perfectly loving and perfectly just, and I'm happy to leave it to them and God in the end. They've landed in a different place to me, and I'm happy to say, you walk your path and I'll walk mine, and we'll keep talking, hopefully, you know.
Okay, cool. Thank you for that, Justin. Andrew, sorry for cutting you off there. Was there anything else you wanted to bring up for Justin before we give him the final question?
Oh, no. So I'll wrap that last thought. If Christianity gave us the foundation through which we can recognize the rights and values of everyone around us, Christianity is to be thanked for that. On the other hand, providing that environment doesn't make Christianity true. And I walked through in this episode a little bit of the way that I go about making my decisions and why they are often counter to what at least the Christianity that we have around here would support. And so for the listeners, I would simply say, look at how you make your decisions. And are they aligned with the best outcomes for the people around you? And if they're not, that is the thought experiment that I'm encouraging. Do the hard work of figuring out how best to support as many people as possible. And you don't appear to need a God for that exercise. Justin, thank you for a conversation that I think was invaluable. I have enjoyed every moment, and I hope we get to do it again in the future.
Well, I've really enjoyed it too. So thank you, Matthew and Andrew. You've been incredibly gracious, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to have some back and forth with you. I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
I feel like we could have done this for the same amount of time again, Justin.
Absolutely.
Dear listeners, you gave me lots of questions and lots of comments, and I've barely scratched the surface. I do genuinely apologize. I'll see if I can dig into my pocket and afford Justin again, and maybe we can sort out something. But you'll have to wait 3 years for it, I'm afraid.
Maybe we won't have to leave it quite as long next time.
Well, if we can do it again, that would be genuinely awesome, Justin. Thank you so much for your time. As is tradition, we like to ask all of our Christian guests one final question just to see the show out. So, Justin, do you have a favourite Bible character, and who are they?
Well, I'm not going to go with the obvious one of Jesus, just because that's a bit too obvious. I think outside of Jesus, I like Peter. Peter reminds me that even people who constantly put their foot in it and get it wrong and deny Jesus and can still be used by God. So that gives hope for all of us, because we're all certainly somewhere in, I could count myself as having got it wrong fairly frequently. But yeah, if Peter can be called the rock and be brought back, then that gives me hope as well. So I think I'll plump for Peter on this occasion.
Go for Peter, the man who likes cockerels. Is that the right one? That's what. Have we had a Peter yet, Andrew? I can't remember. I'm not sure we have.
I don't think we have. We've had Paul. We've had some Old Testament prophets.
We have had a Jesus, but I don't think we've had a Peter. So
there you go. So there you go.
Well done, Justin. Another square on the bingo card there.
Yes. Hey. Good.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much, Justin. Thank you for your time. I hope you have a splendid week. I'm looking forward to our two shows going out. Yours will already have been out for some time by the time this one goes out. I anticipate around about March, this one will go out. There's three in the queue or two in the queue. I can't remember how many now in front of this one. We'll see you about then. I'm looking forward to the feedback for the episode that I've recorded too. As I said, I'm a little bit nervous, to be honest, about what the feedback will be.
Oh, you did a great job. Yeah, I think you did a great job, Matthew.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Justin. That's very kind of you. Yeah. Well, we shall see what the feedback says. I'll keep this prediction on hand, and we'll see what the feedback says. And with that said, until next time, be reasonable. You have been listening to a podcast from Reason Press. Do you have any thoughts on what you've just heard? Do you have a topic that you would like us to cover? Please send all feedback to reasonpress@gmail.com. You might even appear on an episode. Our theme music was written for us by Holly. To hear more of her music, see the links in our show notes.